Thanks very much. Thanks to the organizers for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to come to Toronto. I was at the Field Institute, tried to remember, at least 10 years ago, maybe 11, so it's been quite a while. It's nice to be back. And yeah, I guess I'm going to hit you hard after lunch. This is hardcore math. It gets better after I'm done, I hope. I'm a true mathematician. I collaborate with modelers who collaborate with experimentalists. So we're quite far removed from the morning talks. And so my collaborator modeler is Krasi Tanova. And Jakub Nowacki is our PhD student. And he's an electrical engineer, so I guess I'm the true mathematician in this field. So we work with experimentalists, and I'll show you some of their work, but for me it's really a step removed. Krasi is the person who talks to the experimentalists, and I just drink beer with them. So the experimentalists are Andy Randall and John Brown, it's his postdoc, and they're both also at the University of Bristol. And so I used to be at the University of Bristol, but 9 months ago I moved to New Zealand. And so this is work really as part of the PhD thesis of Jakub Nowacki. So this morning we had talks about theta and gamma rhythms. And you know, I thought I was really prepared, that I'd practiced all the stuff in the jargon I needed to know about Alzheimer's disease to make sure that my talk fits in. It has to do with Alzheimer's, but I didn't know there was any theta and gamma involved, so... Okay, this is a hard bit. How does it work to get to the next slide? Oh, okay. Yeah, it's a right-handed mouse, makes sense. Okay, sorry about that. So, this is experimental results on single cell. Well, it's not, of course, not a single cell, but it's a slice of a pyramidal. I also learned that you don't see pyramidal, which is what I'll probably say a couple of times. It's pyramidal neuron, and this is CSE. That's apparently the boring part, but it's very interesting from a mathematical point of view. And Andy Randall and John Brown, they're trying. Well, they're doing all sorts of experiments on this, and this is to do with understanding Alzheimer's disease. And these experiments are done on 6-month-old mice. So this is in the later stages of the disease. And they're trying, well, I'm not entirely sure what they are trying to understand. What they're telling me is that when they run these kind of experiments, they're interested in how this little bump that you see after the peak, you have a little bump here, and as you change the... you depolarize the membrane potential, then your bump gets a bit higher and higher, and then suddenly you get a response that really incorporates additional spikes. And so what is happening here, and that is, so I look at this from a very mathematical eyes, is the interesting bit is that your current injection here is only 3 milliseconds. It's a short burst, it has a fixed strength or power, and then after that, so the current really is to raise you to the first spike, but then after that you get a response that is completely intrinsic to the cell's own dynamic of being out of perturbation, out of the membrane potential. So its resting state, if you perturb it away from that, there is a dynamics going on that has nothing to do with the actual current injection anymore. That's been turned off already. And so it's a transient behavior that they're interested in. How do you get from this little hump that is called after depolarization, or at least that's our definition. And sometimes the whole hump is also thought of as after depolarization, but we really think of that little hump here, and you could almost see another little hump being created there. That hump, how does that after depolarization actually trigger the spike that follows, or the series of spike that follow. Now, in these experiments, as you see, they're changing the membrane potential, but not by a lot. And you can suddenly get these spikes. Well, you actually, if you're very careful, you can sometimes see only 3 spikes in total or only 2 spikes in total, and you could get even more. And so it's really with the more you raise the membrane potential, the more spikes you expect you're going to get. And so, well, at this stage, I barely knew about these results. Krasi and Jakub were really talking to them and trying to get an actual model of this. Because if you want to, you know, treat this from a mathematical point of view, you need some equations to work with. And so I put this slide in to kind of set the stage and how I think about this. I'm a dynamical systems theorist by training. And when you do dynamical system theory, you learn that things like the membrane potential, that's your that resting potential is a steady state or an equilibrium, and you can have these spikes and those bursts there associated with periodic oscillations. And these notions are well defined as asymptotic behavior in dynamical systems. It's a limit. These things are attractors, or, you know, when you get very difficult in math, then you have saddle type objects that are existing as invariant objects, but you would never see them in experiments. And you're really interested in how these invariant objects change when you change a parameter and what when their stability is changing. But this is all to do with long-term dynamics. This is to do with saying, well, if I let time run all the way to infinity, I get to this equilibrium or to this periodic orbit. And what we're seeing in these experiments is that you give a short kick to the system, and you know what's going to happen when you're at infinity. You're back at the resting potential. It's the route that you take to get there, only 1 spike or 3 spikes. And that's what's of interest. So how can you use these techniques, and in particular, the software that is being developed to deal with all these kind of things? How do you use these tools to investigate transient dynamics? And that's what I found, you know, very interesting question, just from the mathematical point of view. And what I'm trying to do with these models is get the mathematical understanding of what is going on and hopefully inform, I guess, the experimentalist in the end, in my case. Of course, it's the intermediate Krasi modeler who does the real interpretation with Andy and John. But the idea is that we get a mathematical understanding that then informs what is hopefully happening in experiments, and then you could try design experiments that could confirm or actually decide that hypothesis is wrong. But hopefully confirm that your hypothesis is correct and the model is becoming more true to the reality than you had thought initially. And what my talk really is about is trying to show you something that you cannot actually see in experiments and explain that as the mechanism for how you get from a response with 1 spike to a response with 2 spikes and so on. Okay, so transients. What do you do with these transients? How do you get your asymptotic behavior to turn into something that's just a transient? And I guess just to set the stage, and this is perhaps for the experts in the audience here, when you have slow-fast systems, there's a whole theory that was developed by John Rinsel in the early 80s. You have, at least in the biological context, I mean, the relaxation oscillation itself is already from the 20s by Van der Pol oscillators and stuff. But here you get a relaxation oscillation where you get a response that is shown here in the phase plane, where this would be the voltage, that's the vertical axis here, and this is a time response, so this is time. I didn't put any units on, okay, I'm sorry about that. So this is voltage and this is time, and this is voltage again and then a gating variable. And what you see here is green line, which would be the V null line. But this you can interpret as the curve of equilibria depending on this gating variable as a parameter. And you have a branch here of stable equilibria, and then unstable equilibria, and then stable again. And so you have coexisting stable states, and the system, this oscillation, is switching between these 2 stable states. So here we have asymptotic behavior, actual equilibria, actual steady states, and we have a transient phenomenon in a sense that you're switching from say here you go to the stable state and you track the stable equilibrium until, well, it stops existing, and then you switch back, and as you switch back you're crossing this red curve, which is the null line for the gating variable, and so you're changing directions, you start tracking the branch now going down, and then again you switch and so on. And so here is a sort of an ideal of, yeah, there's something transient going on that we're actually expressing here in terms of asymptotic behavior. And so that's quite interesting. And we will see this kind of phenomenon come back in the actual theoretical explanation of what is going on. But my goal is to get a tool, a numerical tool, that once you have done your experiments and you've got a fantastic model that seems to be representing what the dynamics does, that you use this tool to get further investigations of what the model is capable of that perhaps informs what, therefore, your real neuron cells are capable of. Okay, so we need a model. And this is, I guess, 1.5 years of Jakub Nowacki's thesis project, but I'm going to skip it in one slide, more or less. This is, a picture of the actual numerical model that is trying to mimic what the experiments are doing. And so here we have, okay, there's a bit of a translation going on, but you should just really multiply this number by 10, and then you get the input current in the model. And so there's an input current going into the model that lasts exactly the same time length as in the experiment, and instead of raising the resting potential like this, we are changing a conductance, and this SI stands for slow inward, and so that's the conductance for the slow inward current, and I'll get back to that a little bit later. And so here we see that if we increase this conductance, which effectively has the same effect as here, that you raise the membrane potential, except that we don't really see it in the model. It seems to be staying at minus 0.8 here, which is, again, a scaling issue here that you'd really like to have another zero there. But as a mathematician, you don't care. That's fine. It's been non-dimensionalized. But, that's the way the picture came out, I guess. So we have an increase in the conductance. We do change the resting potential a little bit. Then there is the current injection happens after 50 milliseconds, and then you go up, you get a rise, and then it's turned off roughly about here. And so all these responses do almost the same thing in the beginning, but then after that, there are three different responses depending on the value of this conductance. And as you see here, we have a case where there is no hump yet. And then we get the hump, which is the after depolarization, or ADP as being said here. And then you can get here a three-spike response with a little hump. And, well, okay, it doesn't quite match the experiments. And maybe I should say something about this, because we had, I guess, almost arguments with Andy about how accurate the model should reflect the quantitative features of the experiments. And the model that I'm going to talk about is a five-dimensional system of ordinary differential equations that is qualitatively quite representative of what is going on. But the real model that does everything that Andy likes to see, that is really to the level of getting, you know, the curve going like this and the amplitude decreasing exactly right, that is that we can do with an eight-dimensional model. So we have reduced the model a little bit to make it mathematically a little more tractable. And what has happened is that we've tried to pick up what we think, and we is now really, I guess, the modeler, Krasi and Jakub as well, in what we think are the essential features of what shapes this behavior. And, well, I'll get to more of the details on what exactly is involved. Yes.
Is it just more, I just wasn't sure.
Yeah, so the depolarizing here, I don't actually know how to do that in experiments.
Is it like changing a particular conductance in the experiment that's comparable here? I understand.
Yeah, so, well, okay, so my interpretation, I'm not entirely sure what they're doing here. Are they changing a conductance? Can you do that?
Well, you could block conductance, but I mean, because you're doing something different here, right? You're changing the conductance.
Okay, well, I see some people laughing, so there are some people who apparently know the answer to this question, and I don't.
I mean, I don't know the
So in the model, we are changing the conductance.
Okay.
And if that's what's happening in the experiments, that would be great to know, because then we're doing exactly what the experiments are. I thought we were not quite doing what the experiments are doing. But the fact that it qualitatively doesn't look the same, especially the scale here, even if you multiply by 10, doesn't look the same, we can get that. Yeah, that's just the model reduction is a little bit further removed from the truth here. And that's just for mathematical reasons. So, yes. So the effective change in the model is, for as far as I understand it, exactly what's done in the experiments. And how that's achieved, that might be slightly different. Okay. So I wanted to put in a little bit about the mathematical theory of what is already known about this. And I guess this is also a bit for my peace of mind, that this is really new stuff, and you know, not everybody believes that. We submitted the paper, it was really great, and of course it got rejected straight away. So we're still in the middle of trying to get this, the rest of the world to realize how fantastic stuff this is. But there are, of course, people who have looked at excitability in different contexts, and the work that I know quite well is by Sebastian Wiczorek and collaborators in laser dynamics. And so, you know, lasers, that's physics, but you know, lasers are quite similar to neuron cells in many ways. So let's just assume it's a neuron cell. And what you'd have here was this would be the resting potential, and you have a nearby steady state, whatever it would mean in the physiological sense, but it would not be stable. It wouldn't be an attractor. And what you can have is if you give your system a little kick, it just drops straight back to the equilibrium. That would be this response here. But if you give the kick a little higher, then you're crossing this stability boundary. That's really the boundary of the basin of attraction of this equilibrium here. And it is called the stable manifold of this saddle equilibrium. And once you've passed that, you get a hump, a single hump response. And then there's a whole theory on the actual type of the saddle equilibrium that you're sitting there. It has some particular characteristics, and then if you can get that, you can get responses with little wiggles at the end. But more importantly, you can get types where you can get it such that you know that the response is going to be a two-spike response, and you can have a three-spike response. And so all of this, all of these different types of responses, you can get within a small neighborhood in terms of the parameters that you work with in your model. And so you can get all these types of responses by just minor changes in the model. But the way to get them is, again, the way this work is being introduced is by saying I give the system a kick and I check whether the kick is large enough. So we're doing something different. We have a fixed input. It's always the same kick, but we're only changing a parameter. Okay, so you can see that that is quite a similar. And so here comes now the big crucial thing. In our model, we don't have such an equilibrium. So we don't know what kind of boundary it is that we're crossing, if it would be this kind of mechanism. Yeah, there is no additional equilibrium, so you cannot actually go past the stability boundary. Your equilibrium is just stable, always. So this transient response, the explanation of this in this work is not going to be the explanation that works in our model. So there must be another mechanism. Now I put another slide in, and I guess this is based on work by David Terman, who's, I guess, at least from the mathematical side, is almost a neuroscientist to me. But so he has studied this kind of spike-adding phenomena, how do you go from one spike to another, in the context of periodic oscillations. So again, I'm looking at a transient response, If you take periodic oscillations, then it's well known how this works. So this picture here, let me just skip that. But what is happening in the transition from a two-spike to, say, a three-spike response is that you get a coexistence of solutions. So anything blue is an actual oscillator that you can see, and you could, in theory, see in an experiment. And you can see that there is an overlap here in this small parameter regime for this parameter B1 that I'm calling here. And so the model here is coming from this paper with Krasi, that you have a coexistence of solutions. And there are bifurcations going on. There's a whole bifurcation theory about this and what is exactly happening. But the key feature is there are coexisting oscillations. You start somewhere, you go to this oscillator. You start somewhere else, you go to the other oscillator. Well, I cannot have a mechanism like that either, because I always start in the same place. I'm at resting potential. If I would have a parameter regime where I would have two different types of solutions, well, if I start in the same place, I will go to the same solution. There is no way I can have two different responses by starting in the same place and giving the exact same kick. This is a deterministic system. There is going to be a unique response to that. So this mechanism is not possible either. So there is something really interesting going on. I mean, it's exciting from a mathematical point of view, certainly. Okay. So what we started off with is, say, let us just try see what kind of responses we get when we vary the parameter. And so this GSI is that same conductance of the slow invert current. And in this picture here, I'm just showing you a measure of the solution, which is really the entire time response up to actually 300 milliseconds. And so here you see the voltage time series only up to 200 milliseconds. But we go to 300 in this test run, and we only plot it up to 200. And it's kind of very delicate what's going on here. As you see, there is a curve here. This measure of the solution is really an integral across the entire time series. And what is happening is that we get these incredible dips, if you want, and the way this point is running over it to show you all the different time series that we are getting, it spends a long time in these downward peaks. And when you look at what the corresponding time series are like, you have there's a red bit here, that's my 3 millisecond perturbation, that's the kick. And the moment it turns blue, this is the intrinsic dynamics now taking over, the current has been switched off, and I get a response. And every time I enter such a trough, I see this elongated plateau appearing. And elongated in time. Yeah, so the time, if you want, is long enough so that each time after my response, I'm back roughly at my resting potential. But in these downward peaks, what I'm seeing is an elongated, a plateau, as we call it. And it's, there's a little bit of after depolarization here. And as you continue on, it extends and then generates the new peak. And, you cannot see this in an experiment. Yeah. So what we're doing here is we are following a two-point boundary value problem that captures this. And we have a parameter variation here. Each time that we have these peaks, the parameter has to be precise to 10 to the minus 8 in order to see these different solutions. So you have a variation. You're trying to depolarize the resting potential more and more, and you're making small changes. And in an experiment, I think 10 to the minus 2 is already massive in the sense of being very difficult. And so 10 to the minus 8, there's just no way you can tune your system that carefully. So you wouldn't expect to see these plateaus. But we see them in the numerical experiment, and we see that the whole downward trough here that's generated by the fact that I have a low voltage response over a long integration time interval. And so what we're now trying to think of, what do you do with this information? You have a system where you can see that if you go from one spike to two spikes, and then from two to three, it's always via such a prolonged plateau of the after depolarization getting stretched, something like that. And so we have two goals. There's the theory goal, and what exactly is happening here? Just the mathematician wanted to understand all. And then there is the numerical goal, and could you detect something like this? What is the mathematical tool that you would use in order to detect this so that you can do a numerical analysis of your model and just tell you, in anybody, where your changes from one spike to two and so on are in parameter space? And so I want to show you mostly about the tools, but I will show a little bit about the theory. And so here are my equations. There are, in this simplified system, there are five variables. I have voltage, and I have four gating variables. And again, SI means slow inward, and FO means fast outward, and then I have slow outward, and I have slow inward here. And this is, of course, then an activation and inactivation. And so these are Hodgkin-Huxley type formulations, and so we have gating variables and voltage, and it's all conductance based, I guess, is the jargon word here. And so I have a system of differential equations, ordinary differential equations. My right hand side depends on all sorts of parameters, but in particular on this applied current. I turn it on by having the applied current value be, say, 20, and then I turn it off again by putting it back to zero. And that is a discontinuous change. And again, mathematically, oh, that's so nasty. But, no, we can deal with that. And the theory now is saying, okay, let's do what John Rinzel was doing. You turn variables into parameters, and you see how your equilibria depend on these parameters, and then you might see transitions from one equilibrium to the next, which you could really interpret as a transient response. And so we have... There is, of course, the MSI here, which you think is slow, but it's not as slow as these other two here. And so we have two very slow variables, and these are the two that we pick that we're just going to freeze. We're going to set the right-hand side to zero. And now we look at what are equilibria and periodic orbits in this five-dimensional system, which is really a three-dimensional ODE taking place in a two-parameter setting. So the pictures I'm going to show are in five dimensions. So, of course, that would be too good to be true. So we have a projection here, but we really want to think of this living in five dimensions. And so because I have two parameters, I get surfaces of equilibria. And there is a red surface here, and there's a bit of black here, and two other black surfaces here. And so black means it's stable, and red means it's unstable. And so if I would be switching between equilibria, I could be going from this sheet to, say, up there, but I would never get to a red part. And my resting potential, just so that we are clear on this, is roughly over here. It's on this bottom black sheet. And you see two views of the same object. And the projection here is the two slow variables, HSI and MSI, and then this is voltage. And so I've just left the other two out. And so here, this sheet is kind of folded, and it actually this bit folds as well, but we're already outside the physiologically relevant regime. If you're happy with gating variables going negative, then these two do connect up, and there's another fold somewhere here. Okay? And so it's really one big sheet, but we'd like to view it as this is the one that contains the resting potential, and then there's the rest, and that organizes the transient. And these additional nice pink and blue surfaces, they're actually a representation of three-dimensional surfaces of periodic orbits. And so what you're seeing is only a maximum and a minimum value for periodic orbits. Oh, I managed to get them off. Okay, let's see how long this lasts. So, again, for each two choices, one each of the two slow variables, I have one periodic orbit. And so I see a two-dimensional surface of maxima in V and a two-dimensional surface of minima in V, but that's really two points on a single periodic orbit. Okay? And so what is the resting potential is to do with equilibria. The actual spikes, the oscillations, they're to do with these blue stable periodic orbits that I have in the system. Okay. Maybe we should go back here. So what I'm going to show you, what I actually did already, these equilibria, they're going to be different for each different value of GSI. And so this surface that I'm showing is associated with a GSI value that is roughly at this peak here. So that is precise to 7 decimal places. It's only in the 8th decimal place that this is not actually just one point. It's a whole line going down and back up. But to 10 to the minus 7, if you change the 8th decimal place, these surfaces will be almost identical. And so I'm only going to be interested in what happens when I change from being in the one peak response, going down, coming back up, and turn into a two peak response. And all the others is the same thing with extra peaks. And of course, you have a different surface here, but it looks very similar to the one that I'm showing here. Okay? So here, I'm now following the parameter in this 8th decimal place variation into the downward peak, and I get a different response each time. And as you see here, this is where the applied current has been turned off. So the first bit is not plotted. So I get some response, and then I go back to resting potential. And then as I change the parameter, again, it's a minute change, but it has a massive effect on what the trajectory looks like, because as you see here, I'm following, well, this is 5 dimensions, so it's a bit hard. This is due to projection. So you're not going straight through this black plane. The black plane is a plane in 5D space. You just go around it. But this is actually tracking the red surface. So you're tracking the red surface. And you can see that by plotting all sorts of different projections, and I find that confusing rather than enlightening, so I prefer that you just take my word for it. It tracks. And then as it tracks up to here, it drops down, goes to equilibrium. Now you see it tracks. It actually tracks a bit further, and it tracks all the way up to there. You see a little spike coming. We go down to equilibrium again, and now here we see more of a spike coming, and now here we have really a well-developed spike, if you want, and it's kind of moving back. And so we have, if you want, this prolonged plateau that we see is exactly the motion on these red surfaces that you have here. And this is a clear correspondence, because the red surface is actually, these are the slow parts of the relaxation oscillation, if you want. So these are the you go fast to these surfaces, and then you have a slow motion on the surface before you drop back down and transition fast to something else, which in this case is this attracting sheet down there. Yes. GSI is changing, but only in the 8th decimal place. So if you want, it's hardly changing at all. You could almost think of it being constant, but this trajectory is changing enormously. And that is the response that I claim you cannot see in an experiment, because, you know, just getting the value of GSI or whatever the corresponding bit would be in the experiment is very difficult. And so if you would get it, you would see only one of these and not the entire transition. So that is really part of the, I guess, combining the mathematical theory with the numerical tools, that you can see this and that you claim this is the mechanism. Okay, I should really speed up, I guess. So what we're seeing is we're tracking in sort of Rinzel analogy, we're tracking in this transition here, we're tracking such an unstable sheet. And this is actually a similar mechanism that David Thurman has in the periodic oscillations. So these things are really related, but here we have a transient response rather than a periodic oscillation. And so now let me get to the tool. I would like to be able to detect this automatically, not doing this run and seeing like, yep, I've got another spike coming, and yep, there's now another one. That's as if you're running an experiment. You just do a whole bunch of runs and you try to map that out in the parameter plane. I want something nicer, something more elegant, that you really get a curve of your boundary, say, in a two-parameter plane. And in order to do that, we say, okay, rather than running this for 300 milliseconds, we're going to pick up only up to the maximum of this ADP bit. And so we're going to track the first transient bit plus up to that maximum. We want to track that because it's that maximum when that has the maximal integration time that we have the most stretch plateau. You could say, well, that would be the bursting threshold. That would be the threshold for your voltage where you say, now you're developing a spike. And so here is, I guess, this is the slide on the actual algorithm, really. It's saying, use existing code, and we are using AUTO, which is a continuation package for solving two-point boundary value problems. Most people know it as part of XPP, I guess, in this audience if you're doing these kind of analysis. Unfortunately, the way we use AUTO is not implemented in XPP, so you have to learn how to use AUTO hard without the user-friendly interface that XPP offers. But you can do it. You essentially have two boundary value problems that are connected. You have the red bit where you say, I start at resting potential. That gives you a boundary condition. I integrate exactly for 3 milliseconds and then I stop. And then I have an end condition that I use as the initial condition for the next bit. And I stop when I have a maximum, this local maximum at the ADP. And so these are the equations. Let me not dwell on these. That's just the mathematical expression of exactly that. When we do the continuation, you see very obviously when you just plot the variation of this entire boundary value problem as a function of the parameter GSI, you see a very massive change in the total integration time that it takes to reach that maximum. It's pretty small. For just your spike, your little ADP boom, and you go down. Well, the down bit we are not taking into account. We're only going up to that maximum. So that's fast. But then once we start creating the plateau, we're going to get an increase in integration time. And again, this is going to be something that is a massive peak, but it is only a variation of 10 to the minus 8 of the GSI parameter. And here you see what is actually happening inside this bit. So there are lots of colors there. It doesn't come out very nicely, but essentially, what happens is you have the first plateau stretch, if you want, then you go back a little bit, and then you get the longer plateau stretch. And these peaks here is really a response where you go up, and then you have the peak, and at the top you stop, because we stop at the maximum. And so in this picture, you can clearly, I guess, see and perhaps agree with me that we could consider this as the spiking threshold. That's when we develop the spike. And this is what we'd like to detect, but this is the point where we have maximum T. And so in AUTO, that's easy. You just say, okay, I would like to have the moment that T starts from increasing turns to decreasing. That's what I would like to detect. And that you can actually, it's just a feature in the software. You turn it on, and it'll detect it, and it's called a fault bifurcation. So that's great, except that we're not quite doing it that way. We're doing it slightly differently, which is to do with the boundedness of the parameters. We don't know how long T can get. It can actually get pretty long. And we have cases where it goes to infinity, and I'd like to explain that more, but that would be a whole other hour, so let's not go there. But T can grow unbounded. And so we decided that, well, actually, when you have T grow unbounded, then you're inactivation that switches off, so your one current should go much, much lower. Yes, I see now, thanks. And so we expect a minimum in the gating variable of the inactivation, and that gating variable is just between 0 and 1. So we can really detect that in a nice environment where we know that we're not going to grow unbounded. Okay, so this is really my last slide, apart from the conclusions. So what we can now do is use this technique to detect all these boundaries. And so we have the GSI parameter here. And so for a certain, this is another conductance that is thought to be quite important for shaping the ADP and generating the spiking threshold. You can follow, you can detect the onset of a new spike, and then follow it in a second parameter, and you get these curves that really map out where you go from just the first spike due to the perturbation to a two spike regime, three spike, four, five, six, and so on. And so there are a whole lot of other curves here that, for some reason, I ran out of time, so I won't be able to explain you exactly what's going on. But maybe this one curve here, here we have no ADP, and over here we have ADP, so we can detect that as well. So to conclude, we have existing code that if you manipulate it in the right way and you think about your problem in the right way, you can use the existing code to calculate such boundaries, and you can actually have a good mathematical definition of what an excitability threshold actually is. And so that's quite interesting, I guess, also from the neuroscience point of view. Now, we have used a very specific model, but this is not model specific at all. You can use any model you like, as long as you have this slow-fast timescale separation. You don't need to know how the system is separated into slow and fast timescales. You can use this code without realizing what exactly is going on there, but you should have this slow-fast setup intrinsic in the model. And Hodgkin-Huxley style is always like that, so you don't need to worry about it. And so we have our 3 milliseconds in applied current. You could use other experimental protocols. Now, I was thinking, you know, why exactly would you like to do this? And so I think in a way it's very important that you can show that the model is capable of predicting something before you've done the experiments. And so here we have a real map of saying, okay, if you change other parameters in the system, in your experiment, this is when you expect to get a three-spike response, this is when you expect to get a two-spike response, and you could try match that and get better validation of the model that way. And another thing is that once you trust the model very well, of course, we can manipulate any parameter. We can even go negative. So we can do all sorts of things that you cannot do in an experiment and really see how things are related. And so there, I put up two papers here. So this one is really about introducing the model proper, the high-dimensional version. This paper is about the theory. And as I said, the tool that hasn't been published yet, but if you'd like a copy of the preprint, then you can ask me. Thank you very much for your attention. So how? Yeah. So that wide.
Well, but in such a case, how do you think it's possible that when you do experiments like the new one, we can get the gene?
Yes. So I'm not claiming that you would be able to get your experiment here, but in the model, what I get out is I'm claiming that the two spike response is tiny. It's very hard to get a two-spike response. And that's actually confirmed. John Brown says, yep, it's incredibly hard to get a two-spike response. So he goes from no ADP, ADP, and then he tends to get a three-spike response. Well, that's confirmed with our finding because these two curves are more or less on top of each other. Yeah? And so he can... If he can, say, fix his G of O at a particular value and he kind of knows where it is, then he can do the experiments and get the associated GSI values, and you could plot them in this picture and see whether it matches. Alternatively, you could say, I don't actually know what GFO is, but you could match in this picture your responses and get a range for GFO that does that. And, well, to our surprise, really, GFO doesn't seem to influence much where your transition is, right? These are almost horizontal lines. So that was actually a bit of a surprise. Yes?
So just going back to the difference between the experimental protocol and the model protocol for the current convention. So
Okay, I'm not entirely sure that I understand the question. What you're asking is that rather than changing the conductance, what would happen if I change the actual current amplitude that I inject?
Right.
Yes. So you could do that as well. Then your setup here would be that you're starting with a different red curve each time. And so you could run the same code. You just have to define the setup as slightly different, but you could run the same code and see how you change from one spike, two spike, three spike response that way by giving it a higher current injection. And so you can get the same result, but your picture would look quite different there. At some point you would probably get, well, no, so different dynamics entirely as part of the 3 milliseconds, yes. You can easily, when your current is pretty high, you go into a tonic spiking regime, but it'll last you 3 milliseconds and then you turn it off. And then you come back down, because that's what the system is in, at least this one. With the other parameters equal, you just go back to steady state eventually. And so the other responses that you could get, I guess, you know, you could, yeah, I mean, I haven't really said much about whether, you know, this response here, is that really periodic, or, you know, what kind of frequency are we talking and how we go there. You could have a response where perhaps you have modulation on top of these spikes or something like that. Perhaps you could have something like that. We didn't look into that. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I looked it up in their paper, and then they say increased depolarized voltage membrane potential. So I copied it. Yeah. I think from a mathematical point of view, yeah, it was pretty ad hoc. But we had very good arguments on why we were going to reduce it the way we did. And I now know more about this theory that I worry a little bit on how much that has or hasn't changed. But in terms of what you're seeing, we get the same responses, and that was the important part. So the transitions I expect to be the same in the eight-dimensional model. And you could run that. Yes.
Okay.
Now that we know what we're doing,
okay.
So I wouldn't be able to show you the surfaces and that you're actually tracking the saddle things and stuff not so easily in the eight-dimensional model, but this tool you can use in any dimension.
Any dimension,
yes.
That was my other question in terms
yeah.
of the limitation of the tool.
Well, there's a computer limitation,
okay.
I guess.
So then my other question is just in terms of the duration of that pulse, which is 2 milliseconds or whatever.
Three, yeah. Yes, you can just set that as a constant. That's and it doesn't have to be a constant. You can set it as something else. You'd say, I want to get just past that peak up to, I don't know, voltage has to be this much, then it'll make sure that your initial, but you know, that doesn't make sense. Yeah. You could look in that. Yes. Yeah. Change everything.
Okay.
I guess that's the last question, yeah.
I have two very small questions. I think the first one is about tracking the unstable manifold. You said it's a very valid idea.
Okay, so let me make one very, very special point about that.
Should I see that as a canard?
Yes, you should. And it is only at this very special parameter value that I do that, right? I go into this trough and have this whole process happening over a tiny parameter range, and that's exactly that it's a canard, because that's it's an exponentially small parameter phenomenon. Yes. And the fact that we have two steps is a doubly exponentially small phenomenon, so we can track that too.
Then another question is that you cannot really get the work
Okay, so yeah, so that's, I guess, yeah, that's a little bit confusing. So yes, so this point is indeed changing in a tiny bit, but what I'm saying is that if you have a fixed GSI, so your parameter has a particular value, then this has a particular equilibrium state that you start off from. You turn the current on, you go exactly 3 milliseconds, you end somewhere, and then you continue on from there with the current turned off. Now for that same GSI value, this is the only thing I can do. So I cannot say that for this particular GSI value, there would be another possible response, because these 3 milliseconds will give me the same endpoint. And so for each different GSI, of course, yes, I'm varying. But it's the coexistence that is important in David Perman's explanation that we cannot have. I think we should maybe discuss this offline, because, yeah, I can be more precise about this, but it takes too long.